I went to the Antarctic, and I won't say much about the novel. I'll just read. I'm also going to have some images, and to an extent, it's a sort of a dual presentation. It's both words and images. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do it this way, and I always do it this way, is the Antarctic is so visually stunning. And a picture paints 1,000 words. And I think the words and the images complement each other quite well. But actually, the images are a hell of a lot more interesting than anything one can write, which is a bit of a problem as a writer. But I went to the Antarctic. Yes, I've been to the Arctic. I've been back to the Antarctic. I've been back here. I've come from Stoke Newington tonight, not the Antarctic, which is a bit less exotic, but that's where I really live most of the time. And I'm going to read, first of all, a short kind of prologue-ish type piece, quite introspective, quite quiet, called Blue Fields. And it's from a novel called The Ice Lovers, which is, as you might surmise from the title, it's about ice and it's about love and the possible connections between them. And the Antarctic is a pretty unlikely place, in a way, to find love. But for me, that's kind of how it worked out, so that's what I wrote about. And then from Bluefields, we move on to a section which is from the main part of the novel. And just very briefly, the novel takes place in two time frames. The first piece is in 2016, a little bit in the future. The second piece is in 2012, so 4 years before. And there's a mystery, really, which the reader doesn't know about in terms of what's happened and what connects these two time frames. And the other thing I have to tell you is there's lots of words in here. You go to the Antarctic and you learn a new language. So just very quickly, in case you think I'm speaking gobbledygook, I'll tell you that a col is a pass between two mountains. A nunatak is a triangle of mountains sticking out from the ice sheet. The mountain is actually buried in ice. Sastrugi is a Russian word for hard snow, which has been ridged by ice and wind. Viz is what pilots say for visibility, so it's pilot speak, and there's a few things here in pilot speak. Things like frazzle ice, young ice, you'll hear a lot of ice terms as well. There's a term called katabatic, which is a gravity-driven wind, it's a particular type of wind, and the twin otter, which you'll see, is a plane, it's a bush plane. So I hope that makes a bit more sense. So I'm going to switch over to the images now, bear with me, and then we'll have a sort of PowerPoint display.
Technology, how?
Blue Fields. It is the summer of 2016 and he's approaching Blue Fields. He loves the name, even if there are no fields and no blue apart from the searing, rigid blue of the polar sky. Like most places in the Antarctic, Blue Fields, it's not even a place, just a fuel depot marked by a couple of bamboo flags. And yet, when he looks at it, he sees them, the blue fields. Behind him, sea smoke is rolling in. He loves its ermine felt swirl, even if it impedes his visibility. Sea smoke accumulates where cold air meets an open lead of water. It is December now, and the sea ice in the Weddell Sea is finally breaking up. From the air, it looks like muslin, the thin, lacy frazzle ice, ice flowers sprouting on the perimeter of meltwater. This is his favorite moment in the season, early summer, watching the ice loosen its grip on the continent. He fixes his approach on the ice shelf. It's one of those albino days, everything forced into a pigmentless color, not white nor silver, but some new hue, unnamed and misunderstood, projected by the giant skeletal thrust of the ice sheet. The contrast is good. He can see the sastrugi and the fractures. He'll get it down on the deck without a bump. He's been doing this for 10 seasons now. These days, he thinks about it more and more, his 10 seasons south, the chances he's taken, too close to coals, brushing nunataks so that a geologist returning from the field can get some good photos of the strata. Once or twice in a season, he has these moments as he turns them, dips into air pockets, can't get the power he needs to climb, the stern gray face of the mountains looming in the windscreen. They seem out to teach him a lesson. He likes to take risks, of course. He's a pilot. He'd be bored otherwise. He's counting on luck. But he's been doing this for so long now, and he has a theory about luck. It runs out, eventually. His co-pilot is a nervy field assistant. What's his name? They're all called Andy or Mark. He's not particularly good at names, so he keeps these two in reserve as guesses. Well, nervy Andy slash Mark relaxes his shoulders. Little does the field assistant know how much worse it could have been. No viz, poor contrast, him deciding to land anyway, on nerves, on instinct, only inches above the deck, thinking, now, now, now. He can feel it coming sometimes, the land. He can feel it reaching up to meet him. It is an absolutely dingle day. He and the field assistant will spend 2 days flying aviation fuel from the ship, replenishing stocks for the summer season. The ship has just been in to relieve Midas IV, the ice sheet station, nearly 500 miles to the east. He will fly there, too, eventually, drop off the field assistant and take a shower. He'll sit on the platform, which hums all night with the vibration of the electricity generator, watching the sun hover above the ice field. This time of year, it never sets, only skirts the horizon. But first he has to blank down the aircraft. He clambers up the wings, releases the guy wires. It's just like tying a tent to the ground. He kicks the ice stakes in, ties off the tension cord. The plane leans into the torque. It purrs for him like a sled dog. He surveys the landscape then, the white plane, the unfiltered blue sky occupying equal vectors of his vision, the horizon smudged with sea smoke to the north, and feels a slight constriction of his heart. Because the emptiness fails to captivate him as it once did. Now he sees it as vorticeal and scrawny, immense, yes, awesome in its simplicity, but it does not grip and impassion him with that strange, vacant frenzy as it did in the beginning. Back on base, the ship would be arriving about now, carrying the new recruits. December might be the end of the calendar year, but it marked the start of a new cycle in the Antarctic. This year, the ship is carrying a journalist. Or was it an historian? He can't remember the base commander's exact term because what the base commander said next overtook his mind completely. The journalist was writing about the sea ice incident. She'll want to talk to you, I suppose, the base commander said. What could he say? I don't remember. He could refuse to be interviewed. Until now, he's been able to banish memory. But suddenly, there they are, barefoot children slipping gingerly through the long, normally placid grass of his mind. The plane blanked down. He and the field assistant walked toward the edge of the shelf, Mark slash Andy probing for crevasses all the way. The ship sits 30 or 40 feet below them, moored under sheer ice cliffs, the crew on the lookout for ice falls. They'll crane up the war Geordie, as the basket for moving people on and off is called, and he and the field assistant will clamber in. The plane will spend the night on the ice shelf above them, tied down so that the katabatic winds don't flip it over. On the ship, he'll be too hot, too comfortable. He'd rather be bunked down in the back of the otter, how he usually sleeps when he's out deep field. He'll be exhausted, but sleep will refuse to congeal inside him. Now that summer has arrived, there's 24-hour daylight. He never misses the night. He's a reluctant dreamer. He hates being trapped in that choiceless realm of strange rooms, people he's forgotten about coming and going, presenting him with impossible tasks. Lately, he's been struggling with a feeling he calls unrealness, that even in waking life, it's as if he's in a dream of his own making, but cannot remember what it's supposed to be about. He cannot remember what he's supposed to do next. These days are like sea smoke. He waits for them to be dissolved under the full albedo of the summer sun. No, this is definitely not a dream. It's just the beginning of another Antarctic season, ferrying fuel drums back and forth. The ship groans as it nudges the ice shelf. Somewhere around 3 in the morning, the floodlit daylight of midsummer streaming into his cabin window, he falls asleep. So the next bit is the first part of a section called Land of Ice and Fire, and it's 4 years earlier when this same pilot, whose name is Luke, though you never hear it, flies down into the ice cap with another main character whose name is Nara. And Antarctic weather is famously changeable. You can never plan anything in the Antarctic. You go out for a day, you come back 2 weeks later, seriously, that kind of thing. And in fact, this is what happens to them. They get stuck. So I'm just going to That's midnight, by the way, in the ice field here. And a lot of the photographs that you'll see here are places that are very, very rarely seen by anyone. And the photographs are mostly mine, but some of them are a field assistant has loaned them to me. And he's a mountaineer, so I should say thank you. It was the middle of December when they flew down to the Ellsworths, flying against a white sun over muscles of ice driven by a vital current. These were the ice streams, the high-velocity glaciers forced by melt friction from the ice cap into the sea. Cloud types for observers, the meteorological textbook she brought along lay open on her lap. On the way down, Nara tried out names for these unfamiliar shapes, the lenticular clouds, like whipped spaceships, nimbostratus, altostratus, stratocumulus. On the intercom, the pilot said, "You see clouds down here like nowhere else on Earth. Those are my favorite." He pointed out to the cockpit window in the direction of the spaceship. "Wait till winter, then you'll see nacreous clouds too." She stole a look at him then for her position in the co-pilot's seat. A pleasant face, not handsome, a man in his 50s perhaps, his hair still dark. He must feel so capable, she thought. He can fly a machine across the world. He can fly it anywhere into this empty continent, armed only with a GPS coordinate, heading down to Mount Vincent and Mount Gardner in the Ellsworth Range, which even now had been seen by so few human eyes. Nara had met the pilot for the first time that morning at the weather briefing on base. He was poring over satellite maps and weather charts. "Looks like a dingle day," the pilot said. Dingle was an authentic Antarctic word. Nara had learned it already. Although, like other words in the Antarctic lexicon, it had an Antipodean timbre, it meant clear and fine, much as it sounded, she supposed, a little bell ringing. Then, as if he remembered she were there at all, the pilot looked at her and smiled. "Is it your first time out in the field?" "Yes. Well, you'll love it," the pilot gathered up his charts. "I'll see you in the hangar in half an hour." She realized, watching him walk away, that she hadn't asked his name. He would know hers, of course, at least her first name, and would have a vague idea of what she was doing in the Antarctic. "Nobody wants to know about us. We're just the bus drivers down here." She'd overheard another pilot say this in the bar one night soon after she arrived. She resolved that, at the right moment, she would ask the pilot about his life. She would ask him his name. As they landed in the snowfield, a regal, stunned sheet of white rose up to meet them. The skis touched down and a curtain of snow crystals covered the windscreen. Above, the sky was an insolent, lordly blue. But before she'd had a chance to register the cold, the wind, the stinging sun, she was out the door and helping the pilot shift boxes. They were only there to set up camp and fly back to the fuel depot. The others were being ferried down in the larger plane with the skidoos, the sledges, the rest of the tents. All of this was decided in the same logistical haze she'd barely become accustomed to. Everything in her new life was governed by the field operations manager, the weather, or a cunning hybrid of the two. Everything was beyond her control. She was expected to do as she was told. "When did I join the army?" she wondered. She hadn't meant to. Then boxes, squeak of snow, zinc smell of factor 60, the metallic taste hovering on the edge of her lips. And suddenly, she felt forsaken, not by anyone she knew, not by any human being, but by a much larger entity which had suddenly appeared and expanded all around in the brass sky, in the cold zeal of air. Some brutal sensor was looking at her and it had her snared in its gaze. She registered all this with a thin, skating alarm. She was not religious, she'd never had such a thought in her life. "What's the matter?" She looked up to see herself staring back at her, a reflection in the pilot's polarized sunglasses. These sunglasses, official issue, had the effect of thinning out people's faces, drawing up the corners of their mouths. They looked like a troop of black-eyed aliens. "Nothing, sorry. We better get a move on. The Met said the weather could close in today. Something about a low-pressure system over the Bellingshausen. I reckon we should make tracks back to Ice Blue." They worked quickly, erecting one of the pyramid tents in minutes, weighing it down with snow, tying off the valence. Then they rolled the skidoo from the back of the fuselage. She stole a moment to look at the landscape around her. The mountains were the color of cinders. White cascades of ice coursed down their flanks. These peaks, the Ellsworths, were 20 miles away, but they towered right above them. She felt as she could touch them. There was something else. It was as if the mountains were moving, very slowly, toward them. "We might be the first human beings to set foot here," the pilot said. "I'll plot the GPS and look at the data when we get back to base. Then we'll know for sure." "How many people in the world can say that? I'm the first human ever to stand here." She didn't want to spoil his magic, but the scientist in her said, "Is it possible to know for sure?" "Of course, this is the Antarctic. It's like nowhere on Earth. We're not actually on Earth here, now that I think about it. No, it's like outer space, a new planet, a new life. His laugh then was strange and private. She could not see his eyes. Now, 7 hours after they first landed, the pilot was in the cockpit talking to base on the HF, a minor mechanical problem discovered when he revved the engines to fly them out. A sour expression toyed with his lips, dragging their edges down. It was more than a mere tick. He might be this, Nara thought. Sour, heavy, one of those men so gallant on the surface, but who turn mean with disappointment. The weather changed so quickly. She only had time to perceive a gleam of albedo before the sun was shuttered by cloud, then a dark, unnaturally fast, as in an eclipse, the chrome edge of a blizzard. Her watch read 2, but it could have been 2 a.m. or 2 p.m. In the 24-hour daylight, they looked exactly the same. The pilot was outside, sitting splay-legged up on the wing of the plane, pliers in hand. Do you know how to fix it? Before I was a pilot, I was a mechanic. Is there anything I can do to help? I don't think so, but thank you. Here he said her name, and it emerged formal and slightly chastising, as if she were being told where to sit or put to bed. Maybe you could go and get some snow to melt for dinner. She put on her salopettes, her 3 fleeces, her thin summer windbreaker, not at all proper issue for this kind of weather this far south. The pilot turned away discreetly as she put on more clothes, even though there was no flesh to be seen. Yes, he was old-fashioned, this man. He was courteous. She felt guilty for having judged him a sour man, perhaps disappointed, volatile, untrustworthy. She'd been in a habit of making these instant stinging judgments since coming to the Antarctic. It was a certain anxiety about being cooped up with other people, she thought, about being at their mercy. She felt him clip something into her back. What's that? That's your lifeline. But I'm only going to get snow. That's what they all say. One step beyond the fuselage's windbreak, she felt the wind. It drove snow into her face and stung. Her fingers were instantly cold. Bracing herself, she picked her way. It was not uncommon for hidden crevasses to be open when planes landed. It took longer than she thought to shovel through wedges of snow into a metal bucket. And when she stood up, a shield of gauze met her eyes. The plane had disappeared. In the swirling snow, she couldn't even see her hand. The gauze was not only in her eyes, her ears, but her mind. She felt a sudden vertigo and also a nausea. She took 10 steps in the direction of the plane. Stars gathered and dispersed in her eyes. Then she felt a tug at the small of her back. And then she was being pulled backwards. In 20 steps, she was back at the plane. You were heading off in the wrong direction, he said. I don't know what happened. Good thing I had hold of you, the pilot smiled. Now, how about some dinner? Have you heard of that famous restaurant, the Twin Otter? They say it can be hard to find, but once you do, it's worth it. That night, the storm intensified. They spread their pee bags on opposite sides of the fuselage. The pilot lit 3 tilly lamps and hung them from hooks in the crossbeams overhead. The lamps swayed with the plane when it was buffeted by gusts. What's that you're reading? She turned the book toward him so that he could see the cover, The Worst Journey in the World. He smiled. Everyone reads that down here. Well, I'm sorry I'm not more imaginative. He looked away. I didn't mean it like that. I know. She managed not to say, I'm sorry. Wait till you get to the part where they etherize the albatross to death on the deck of the Terra Nova. Now there's a sad, sad episode. All of them flapping behind the albatross, trying to pin it down. They were so trusting, those birds. They didn't have any predators then. They're more wary now. I wonder how many generations it takes for that information to be passed on. How many mutations? Who was this man? He was intelligent, well-spoken. He was different from his taciturn colleagues, the ex-bush pilots, the ex-army pilots. But then he was not wholly unlike them either. In the cockpit on the way down, she'd asked him, why did you become a pilot? And he answered her, I like speed, I like machines, that's about all there is to it. When she digested this answer, she thought, yes, you could ruminate too much on the whys of something. Why could be a big waste of time. But I'm not getting far with reading it, she said. I think I've only managed the introduction. It's too close to what I'm actually experiencing. You mean you could read it on a hot summer day, lying in a park in London? Hot days, parks, London, Such things were unimaginable by now, and so quickly, she had the impression she'd left that world forever. The pilot rolled over on his back. In the dim light, she could only see the breath rising from his balaclava. I know I shouldn't talk about where we're not. It's like how you miss people down here. It's as if they've died, or you've died, or they're carrying on in a separate time frame. That's what I think ghosts are, you know? They're there, living right beside us, but there's an invisible curtain between us. A blow hit the plane. It swayed, then swapped, then rocked. That'll be a catabactic gust straight off the mountains, he said. It felt like we were going to tip over. We would if we weren't blanked down, and this is midsummer. Imagine winter. Sometimes, when I'm out here, I think about what those men went through, the Scots, the Shackletons. He turned to face her again, propping himself up on the elbow. You know what I think, though, is the saddest story of them all. Shackleton, when he went back to London, after surviving the wreckage of the Endurance, making his way back to South Georgia, rescuing his men left behind on Elephant Island. It was 1918. The war was on. Do you know what he did? She had to admit she didn't. He gave lectures to a half-filled Philharmonic Hall twice a day. Imagine what the man had just done, how he'd saved his men against all the odds, and he had to stand up there and tell people how he'd failed to cross the Antarctic every day, twice a day. It was more cut and dried in those days. Success, you come back a hero. Failure, you're a pariah. No psychologist, no post-traumatic stress disorder, no coming to terms with things. The hall should have been packed out, but nobody cared, because there was a war on, because he'd failed. You know what Shackleton said? His secret was that he was able to get over disappointments quickly. He said, a man must shape himself to a new mark directly as the old one goes to ground. I think about that a lot. This is the last thing she remembers hearing. From time to time, the plane shudders in the wind. Otherwise, the silence is deafening. She can hear her own heart, even the blood humming in her veins. Then she's in a different dimension. The storm, the plane, the pilot, they're all separate for her. They're all on the other side of the curtain. She sees a man. He's talking to people. They sit row on row. Behind him, a film rolls, a modern video stream of ice floes. On them, dark, gleaming lozenges like wet seals. But something's wrong. She watches as a creature surfaces from the deep. The man tells the audience how killer whales would circle them. Their horrible eye, big as a man's head. Their black and yellow mouths, the fishy stench of their breath. The man begins to cry. The film flickers against empty rosewood chairs. The few people left in the hall are all women. They sit there, primly in their hats. The man's voice booms into the crevasses of empty rows until there are only two or three women left. Their faces lengthen and contort until they're all screeching like the figure in Edvard Munch's The Scream. In the depths of night, which is not night, the pilot asks, "You okay?" Is she talking in her sleep? It's been so long since she slept in the same place as anyone. On the ship she had her own cabin, and the night they slept together, he did not stay. She rolls back into sleep. Someone else's words in her head, the pilots, the man on the podiums, the ghosts on the other side of the curtain, but it's sleep talk, fragmented, not unlike ice breaking up in summer. Something about having done your best, of being proud of what you do, of being forsaken by God. Nice triumphant image to end on. A tattered Union Jack at Halley. Thanks very much.